My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to say how pleased we are that you joined us today. Your registrations for this teleclass help to make it possible for us to give unlimited free access to all of our teleclass materials to healthcare professionals in developing countries. So on their behalf and on ours, thank you very much. Our teleclass faculty today is Dr. Stephanie Dancer. Dr. Dancer is a world-renowned microbiologist and researcher and lecturer in the control of antibiotic resistance. And I should say, too, that not only has she made good use of her brain and produced some very classy research, she is also a world-class athlete, particularly in the sport of rowing. So to present the teleclass, Evidence Behind Interventions to Control MRSA, from the Scottish Centre for Infection and Environmental Health in Glasgow, Scotland, it is my great pleasure to present Dr. Stephanie Dancer. Stephanie.
Hello, Paul. Hello, everybody, and thanks for listening into the telecast. I was about to say this evening, but of course it's not necessarily this evening where you are. So I hope things are fine where you are and you're ready to listen to what I have to say about this particular subject. I'm blushing a bit because Paul seems to think that I'm a world-renowned athlete. I'm not sure if I actually got to that standard, but I did try quite hard a long time ago. Anyway, it's a long distance from the river to MRSA, and the reason why we're all here is because we feel strongly about MRSA and its control. And there are lots of reasons why we feel strongly about MRSA and its control. It's because coagulase-positive staph are probably the commonest bacterial pathogens worldwide, which means that if we lose the ability to treat these organisms, we're facing untreatable infection, the sort of infection that maybe our grandfathers knew about within 100 years, only 100 years of antimicrobial chemotherapy, and we seem to be losing it. And for this particular organism, that's not such a good idea. Now, the methicillin resistance bit of methicillin resistant Staphylococcus aureus is almost, not quite, but almost synonymous with multiple resistance. So when you say it's an MRSA, I guess it doesn't really matter whether it's methicillin resistance or whether it's multiply resistant Staph aureus. It means difficulty in treating. If you'd like to go on to the first slide there, you'll see some data from the European Antimicrobial Resistance Surveillance Scheme, which was funded by the money from European Commission and started off in 1998 with data collection from 1999. And you can see there from this slide just why we say the UK is up there with Club Med, because the red colour filling in there, many of the Mediterranean countries and indeed the UK, signify that greater than 30% of all staphylococcal bacteremias are due to MRSA. And this is something that we are acutely aware of here in the UK. And over the course of this talk, I'm going to try and explain why that's the case. And I'm also going to try and explain what we can do about it, because I think that the things that we can do about it are actually quite simple. Maybe putting them into place is not quite so simple, but there are things that we can do, even in an endemic situation, and even in countries like us where there is a very high rate of this particular organism. Now, we're just going to go on to the next slide, and this is EARS data again, and this shows you one of the other concerns we have about MRSA, and it's not just because of the position of the UK in the MRSA League, it's because the fact that we have increased. We've increased significantly from 1999 to 2001, and we're waiting for the next round of data to tell us where we are UK-wide. But I've actually got a treat for you, and I've got some Scottish figures for you, which we've only just put together. So if you'd like to carry on to the next slide, you'll see there that the proportion of Staph aureus bacteremias due to MRSA for Scotland appears to have dipped a little. At the moment, I'm trying not to be too optimistic, and I say we've steadied, but there does seem to have been a dip just within the last year, and I hope very much to be able to intimate throughout my talk why I think this might be, and then I'll give it to you on a plate in the conclusion as exactly why I think our rate has perhaps come down a little bit. Now, can we move on to the next slide? before I start diving into all the different interventions to control MRSA, and I'm sure many of you know as healthcare professionals and indeed infection control professionals that the epidemiology of this organism makes its control particularly complex. But I feel I do have to justify why we should control it, quite apart from the fact that it's that the incidence is going up, because there are still people who think that maybe MRSA is inevitable with the global consumption of antimicrobials driving resistance, and that perhaps we should put our money into something else. Well, I don't subscribe to that view, and I actually think that there are more and more microbiologists now in the UK who think the same way as I do, in that we really do have to tackle this organism. Now, this slide here, and for the benefit of those who aren't in the UK, but you still might recognize the gentleman on the left there, that's Roger Moore, and well, of course, you know him as James Bond. In actual fact, he's the saint here. And at the other end of the spectrum, I've got there a rather nasty, vicious-looking pumpkin, and the reason for that was because I put this slide together at Halloween for another talk on a similar theme. And I've done this because Staph aureus is just like people. You've got your chainsaw massacrists at one end, and you've got your saints at the other. And what I want to do is really illustrate the pathogenicity spectrum of Staph aureus, in that there are certain strains of this genus which will kill. So often I've come into the hospital and we find that a patient has got a positive blood culture with Staph, and by the time I phone up to find out how this patient is, I'm told the patient has passed away. And of course the next day, it's Staph aureus. On the other hand, you've got strains of Staph aureus which are so benign that even if you actually injected them into somebody's bloodstream, they probably wouldn't even show a flicker of temperature. And indeed, one of the benign strains we use, our Oxford strain Staph, which we use in the laboratories every day as a control Staph against other organisms we're testing. So there's this spectrum of pathogenicity. And there was certainly a great deal of dissent when MRSA first raised its ugly head as to whether it was as pathogenic as methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus. And indeed, it was thought at that time that the metabolic burden of extra resistance would detract in some way from pathogenicity. That's actually not the case, because I think MRSA has just as much opportunity to be a killer as the ordinary Staph aureus. But what's happened in the UK is that we've got some epidemic strains which are so good at spreading and sticking to people that we actually think pathogenicity is directly proportional to the properties of these strains, which are in fact reasonably benign. They are nasty for people who are ill in the hospital, but for people hopefully like you and I who are not immunocompromised and who do not have wounds, then they're not so much of a problem. So it's difficult to say that MRSA is not as pathogenic as Staph aureus. I believe it is. I believe you have to look carefully at the strains worldwide and not get taken in by what your local strain's doing. Now we'll just go to the next slide, and you'll see there an ulcer. And if you look at the ulcer and the skin surrounding it, you'll see that the skin is shiny with the edema, the localized edema, and you'll see that it's red. And you can see the pus there forming in the ulcer. And I'll tell you the story of this lady. This is a lady that we'll call her Catherine. And she was in her 70s, and she was a fit and well 70-year-old on no medication. And she just happened to bash her leg against a supermarket shopping trolley and received an abrasion. And it was over the bone, over the tibia, which meant it was difficult to suture. So she came into the local casualty, and it was steri-stripped and dressed. She was only in the casualty for a couple of hours, but the net result of that, I'm assuming, was that she picked the MRSA up from the casualty environment, and this was what this ulcer looked like a year later. Now, I feel particularly concerned about this because Catherine wasn't systemically unwell, and she was being managed in the community with daily dressings, etc. She even, unfortunately, had a couple of doses or a couple of courses of flucloxacillin and erythromycin, which would have done nothing for MRSA. In fact, it probably would have made it worse. But the very fact that she wasn't seriously unwell meant that she didn't actually receive any other treatment until she came to my attention and a new GP, and we decided to try to do something about it. So the longer you leave MRSA, as in common with some other organisms, the more likely it is to become virulent. And I'll probably say a wee word about quorum sensing as we go along. Let's go to the next slide. Now, this is the results of a study that was actually done in the hospital where I trained, in London, in the UK, at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. I have to say I was a junior at this stage and didn't really appreciate what was going on. But it was the result of an onslaught of an epidemic MRSA, which was not the 15 and 16 that has taken off over the UK since then. This was actually the first epidemic strain characterized. And you can see that there were at least 40 cases of infection. This was over a year. And 3 deaths directly attributable to MRSA. And the authors made great pains to distinguish exactly what the impetus of MRSA was to the patients who contracted it. And they instituted a particularly stringent control measure, which was screening and isolation and closure of wards and movement of patients, restriction of movement of staff, which took a great deal of time and some resource to put into place. But they justified their control measures because of the particular pathogenicity of the epidemic strain MRSA-1. Now, MRSA-1 was evident in the UK hospitals in the 1980s. We think it possibly came from the Middle East. But since then, of course, we're now up to eMRSA number 17. But it's 15 and 16 that have the properties for spread, 15 and 16 which show the epidemic property sufficient to almost take over the UK. Now, we're just going to go to the next slide. Pathogenicity issues. There are more, and I feel I do have to include these in my justification for why we need to control MRSA. And there are lots and lots of articles that one could use, but I've selected a few for you here, which I think are particularly good. And the two at the top there, Muda et al. And Pujol et al., describe how carriage of MRSA is more likely to lead to infection. And they do this with just straight retrospective and prospective screening. And the Muda reference, of course, was in a veteran hospital, almost like one of our UK nursing homes. The Pujol reference, though, of course, was from a study done in the intensive care unit. Moving on, MRSA bacteremia does have a worse outcome than methicillin-susceptible version. In fact, methicillin resistance is an independent risk factor for death. Now, it's very difficult to sift through whether this is something to do with the treatment difficulties or whether it's something else. Many of us think that it's not just due to the fact that it's difficult to treat, that there is something else in there too. But it's very difficult to sift through and put your finger on exactly why. And then finally, vancomycin is not as good at treating MRSA as flucloxacillin and the other related flucloxacillin-like antibiotics are for methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus. And the paper that I've cited there, Gonzalez, it does include quite a lot of ideas about why this should be. But most of us as microbiologists know how painfully slow it is to get a positive reaction from when a patient has got septicemia due to MRSA. It's sometimes a couple of days before you see the temperature come down when you give a patient intravenous vancomycin for MRSA. It seems to work so slowly. I wonder whether it's just a simple matter of penetration because the glycopeptide antibiotics are huge molecules, and we know that they don't penetrate lung very well. Flucloxacillin, on the other hand, is very good for methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus, and particularly so when you add in a little bit of a minor glycoside for synergy. Now, we'll move on to the next slide, and here is an electron micrograph, and it shows you ciliated nasal epithelia and the characteristic clustering of Staphylococcus aureus adhering to those cilia. We still don't know, really understand how and why Staph aureus sticks so well to the nose. my goodness me, if we could find something, not an antimicrobial, which would actually stop this organism sticking to noses. And the epidemicity, or that's how easily the strain spreads, this is something which the organism displays, particularly our UK strains, so well. But it's, the story doesn't stop there, because the recent work which various groups have done across the world on quorum sensing suggests to us that the organism is even cleverer than we first thought, in that it can send out molecules of peptides and lactones and various other inducer molecules which sense the density of the resident population. And these various chemicals will feed back to the colony and tell the organism exactly how many of their colleagues are there jostling on a mucosal or a ciliated surface. And there, when there's a huge colony where you don't need to worry about adhesion, there's a genetic switch to virulence, because that's when the AGI locus will switch on to producing its toxins and its enzymes, which promote invasiveness of the organism. I think this is very interesting work, and I wonder whether there will be people working on inhibitors to these sensing molecules to be able to maintain the organism in an adherent state rather than turn it into a pathogen. Now we'll move on to the next slide. And on the epidemicity front, I'm going to give you a quote from Andreas Vos, who's a Dutch microbiologist, and he gave a talk about MRSA at a recent conference we had here in Scotland in 2002. It was our Hospital Infection Society conference. And Andreas said, well, are MRSA more transmissible than methicillin susceptible Staph aureus? No, they're not. It's because these epidemic strains, which have spread across the UK, have skewed the usual epidemiology. But I'm quite certain that if we looked at the plethora of strains across the world, we would find very little difference between Staph aureus and MRSA. Now we'll move on to the next slide. And I've got more for you on why we need to concentrate on controlling MRSA. An argument by the Don't Control MRSA Brigade a few years ago was that MRSA is replacing MSSA in the hospital. Well, it doesn't. It adds to the burden of MSSA. And secondly, if you've got MRSA in a hospital, and if you've got lots of patients with MRSA in a hospital, it does seem to correlate quite strongly with the number of patients with MRSA bacteremia. And I'll be returning to that study by Stephen Harbath a bit later on in my talk. And then another quote here from Lorena Herwalt, in the MRSA incidence reflects the general effectiveness of infection control practice. It certainly does. It's the best marker we have of hygiene. I used to say to the students a few years ago that it was the best marker of hospital hygiene. But, you know, I've changed my mind now, and I just say it's the best marker of hygiene, because I think that the street between the hospital and the community runs both ways, and there are plenty of places in the community where hygiene should be prioritized. And finally, a quote from another Dutch microbiologist, if you can control MRSA, you end up controlling other hospital-acquired infections. And I firmly believe that that is the case, because the ability of MRSA to survive in the environment is very much like a few other organisms that we have problems with here in the UK, and I suspect in other countries too. For example, Clostridium difficile and vancomycin-resistant enterococci. These organisms love hospital environments, and if you're targeting your hygiene in a hospital, you're going to target these organisms too. We'll move on to the next slide. Let's have a look at the community prevalence of MRSA and more justification for why we need to do something about this organism. There is no doubt whatsoever that MRSA now is not just a problem in hospitals, and I cannot believe that anyone doubted that that would ever be the case. As long ago as 1982, that first reference there from Sarah Velatz describing an outbreak of MRSA in the community. This was among intravenous drug abusers who were self-administering cephalosporin antibiotics. These patients, on admission into hospital, then set off a hospital outbreak of MRSA. And next we have the shocking report of 4 deaths in children from community-acquired MRSA. One or two of the children who'd actually picked up the MRSA from siblings and other sources who'd been in hospital or had hospital contact. But nevertheless, I think that was probably a very significant report. And I'm saddened to hear of the recent deaths from MRSA among children with flu. I think from the USA. You will correct me if I'm wrong about that. I just heard that a couple of days ago. And then a comment from Professor Hiramatsu in Japan about the trends in Staph aureus infections, the fact that we have now increasing glycopeptide resistance in the hospital and methicillin resistance in the community. And I know in this particular paper, Hiramatsu asks whether the MECA, the mobile MECA gene, which is found in the community in MRSA, has perhaps come from the methicillin-resistant coagulase-negative staph, which also appear to be increasing in the skin, on the skin of people in the community. And then I have to include this one. This is a subject close to my own heart. And this is about the strains of MRSA in the community, which appear to be very different molecularly to the strains in the hospital, and the fact that the Pantone-Valentine leukocidin gene is being carried also in conjunction with the MECA resistance facility. Certainly in Europe, I'm not sure whether that's the case elsewhere, we think that the fusidin being prescribed by GPs in the community might be fueling some of these community MRSAs with the PVL gene. And this gene, of course, is a virulence determinant and very much a problem in patients who succumb to it. Now we'll move on to the next slide. And this comment here, again from Hiramatsu, I agree with entirely, and I think it's always been the case, that the increasing trend of MRSA infection in the community shows that MRSA has started to replace MSSA to establish itself as our ultimate natural flora. And this is just as the penicillin-producing Staph aureus did in the 1940s and 50s, and our problems with this penicillinase producing Staph aureus in the hospitals in the 1960s in the UK is almost identical to the situation that we're experiencing now. How quickly we forget the lessons of the past. And of course, if you move on to the next slide, you'll see that I obviously wasn't the first person to say that. And now we'll move on to the next slide. And I've put here, this was the first report of Staph aureus resistant, totally resistant to vancomycin. So not the intermediately resistant strains, first described by Hiramatsu, with a huge cell wall built up following many weeks of exposure to vancomycin, but here in a discrete genetic transfer of plasmid with vancomycin glycopeptide resistance, possibly from concomitant isolation of vancomycin-resistant enterococci. And of course, there was a follow-up to that in that there was another strain a bit later on that particular year. I think this is good justification to concentrate very much so on controlling MRSA, not just in our hospitals, but elsewhere too. We'll move on to the next slide. If all this hasn't convinced you, if you have managerial inclinations, perhaps you would like to know that there are far more than the 4 references that I have here on just how much MRSA is costing hospitals. I've just selected 4 references here which we can briefly summarize, but there are plenty more if you start looking, and you can actually put together a very nice report on exactly how much money you can save if you put into place interventions to control MRSA. The first report there, MRSA infections cost 3 times more to manage than infections with susceptible Staph aureus. And then we have a report here from Rayo in 1988, basic control programs, and I will define what basic control programs are a bit later on, cost approximately half that of treating one single MRSA bacteremia. And another report underneath that, screening patients from other hospitals could save thousands of dollars. And, of course, these particular authors sat down and costed exactly that. And that was a great deal of money. And finally, a report from the UK, which I'm going to come back to, from Anita Rampling, who showed that if you double the cleaning on one ward, you can get rid of an epidemic MRSA, which was pathogenic, and you can save £28,000. And that was in the 6 months following a cleaning intervention. So just a few references that I've picked out of the hat there to show you that you can save a great deal of money by concentrating on controlling this organism. The problem is, of course, as with any preventative intervention, how can you cost something that doesn't happen? And the other problem is, all that work that infection control practitioners do, the money saved doesn't necessarily go back to them or their department or the microbiology lab, because, of course, the savings may well be reflected outside those departments in acute medicine and surgery. We'll go on to the next slide now. Now, I'm going to say a few words about the UK guidelines for the control of MRSA in hospitals. And I think the original guideline was in 1986, and then we've had revisions in 1990 and in 1998. And last year was convened another UK group to look at MRSA and its control, which has further split into three. And we're hoping very much that they're going to produce something which will show us the way. I feel perhaps that our European colleagues are laughing at us because we keep revising our guidelines. Well, chaps, most of you haven't got so much of a problem as we have, so maybe you can learn something too when our new guidelines come out. But the point I'm going to make, and the next slide indeed, I'm going to try and explain why these control measures haven't worked here in the UK. Let's move on to the next slide. Now, this was a whole load of ideas and snippets, which I have actually added to. I hope Gary won't mind. Gary French, our professor of microbiology from St. Thomas's Hospital in London, who gave a talk on the control of MRSA at the same conference that Andreas gave us his lecture. And Gary had a go, good for him, and tried to put together all sorts of reasons, which I've just landed on you on this slide, to try to explain why the UK guidelines haven't worked. Well, maybe they're not stringent enough. Well, I don't subscribe to that because I actually think there's quite a lot in those guidelines. The last one in particular was a very nice review of MRSA control. Well, what about the next one? MRSA is being brought back into hospitals. Yes, it is. I've told you that the street between the hospital and community runs both ways, and patients are getting older. Our life expectancy is going up. We have a better standard of living, and therefore the degenerative diseases of old age, which precipitate patients into hospital, don't go away, and they come back. And if they have picked up MRSA, I'm afraid it's very difficult to get rid of sometimes, and colonization can be particularly prolonged. I'm sure all of you have had experience in patients with long-term colonization of MRSA. Of course, in the UK, we do have pressure on beds, very much so, and certainly the older patients do block beds because we don't have facilities to transfer them to. There has been a reduction in the number of nursing and residential homes in the community, and this means that a patient who doesn't necessarily need acute medical care is blocking a bed, and if he or she has MRSA, they are a risk to themselves and to others. We have a problem with mupirocin resistance. At the last count, I think it was between 5 and 10% of all our MRSA isolates. It varies in pockets across the UK. Certainly, it's far more difficult to clear a mupirocin-resistant MRSA than it is a susceptible strain. We use all sorts of things. I've had personal success using Polyfax and Fusidin together, but I find that the just putting creams up the nose is not really very good. One does have to pay attention to the rest of the patient too. We don't have enough isolation facilities. There is no doubt at all about that. However, I will examine the evidence for isolation a bit later on, which makes that possibility perhaps not quite so high on the priority list. We have more specialist procedures. Doctors are getting clever. There are all sorts of keyhole surgery, endoscopy, and molecular biology going on, which means that more patients are receiving more complex treatment, patients who perhaps would have died previously. The wards in the UK hospitals are crowded, and this is, of course, because we have huge pressure on waiting lists, particularly for cardiovascular and orthopaedic procedures. We call it hot bedding. A patient is scarcely out of bed before another patient has moved in there. And you can track the movements of patients all over the hospital if they've been on four different wards within the past 24 hours, and we identify them to have MRSA. How do you then go back and screen patients at risk who may have come into contact with that patient? It's very difficult. Understaffing. I think this is very important, particularly trained nurse staffing. For example, in the intensive care unit situation, where you've got a nurse looking after each patient because of the complexity of their management, nurses do have to go on breaks. They do need to go and have their cup of tea. And if you've got a patient with a tracheostomy who blocks off, I don't think there's time to wash hands before a nurse goes to that patient. And therein, of course, we have a particular problem with the transmission of MRSA in intensive care. But I also think understaffing is an issue for the rest of the hospital as well. For the UK also, there's been a serious erosion of microbiology teaching for our students. There's been all sorts of reasons for this, a move towards problem-based learning and to try and cut down on the huge amount of facts that medical students were expected to ingest over the course of their 5 or 6 year medical curricula. We're trying to address this. There are UK groups looking at this and how we can introduce microbiology teaching and, in particular, antibiotic prescribing into the undergraduate curriculum. Goodness knows how we're going to cope with the other prescribers. And we do have other professions who prescribe. That includes nurses and chiropodists, and there are others. We haven't thought about them yet. Hospital mergers have happened in the UK, and there has been a move towards service and laboratory centralisation. And the creation of these pathology supermarkets may look good on paper. The managers may think you will save money, but I'm afraid the net result of this is to complicate infection control. The presence of an infection control nurse on a ward in a hospital is so important, because there are things that happen which might not be important enough for busy staff to phone up about, but if an infection control nurse appears in the doorway, it's so easy to bounce ideas off him or her. The next one, senior staff have underestimated the importance of basic cleaning. This is a subject very close to my own heart, because I think senior staff have underestimated the importance of MRSA and not just cleaning. I think I'll say more about that later. And there has been a lack of leadership for infection control seniors. We've had the group that don't believe in MRSA control, and we've had the group that do. Until we stop this pendulum swinging, how are the rest of our doctors going to take the message if even the microbiologists and infection control seniors can't agree? And, of course, our worsening infrastructure in the national health system. We'll move on to the next slide. And I'm going to tackle topical clearance because I'm acutely aware that this is often used by the Don't Control MRSA Brigade because they say, well, we spend ages bathing patients in disinfectants when they've got 6 weeks to live, and it's uncomfortable for them, it's unpleasant for them, it's heavy on nursing time, and they don't work because the patient always seems to recolonize. Well, I am aware that there's no evidence for this, there's very little evidence for this. But of course, we don't really know when most of the time these topical clearance regimens are probably not being done properly. If you're going to do it, then you need to pay attention to all sorts of bits and pieces. And yes, it is hard work. You need to remember the hair. Because if a patient's carrying MRSA, whether it's in their nose or whether it's in a wound, they will put their fingers into their noses like we all do, and they will put their fingers under the dressings and feel their wounds or scratch their wounds. Infected wounds itch, and so do partially healing wounds. the fingernails, of course, it stands to reason that the organism can survive under fingernails. So if I'm going to try and clear a patient where it's vitally important to clear a patient, I usually advocate the use of a disposable nail brush in a 3-day topical clearance regimen. Clothes and footwear are important because people forget the dressing gown hanging up on the back of the door. We had a lady with a fluffy pink bed jacket, and we couldn't understand why we couldn't clear her from MRSA. And it was important to do that because she needed a hip replacement, and the orthopedic surgeons were most reluctant to operate while she was carrying MRSA. When somebody's sharp eyes, not mine, I'm afraid to say, noticed the fluffy pink bed jacket, we actually pressed it against some agar plates and found it growing the same strain of MRSA. We took it away and washed it. And the next time, this lady was clear of MRSA. Now, that's a positive story. And for every positive story, there's probably many negative. But at least I can tell you that that really happened. Of course, the same thing with soft furnishings and toys. These fluffy materials, particularly if there's any synthetics in them, attract MRSA. It's very difficult to get rid of without taking them away and cleaning them. Washing at high temperature, which quite often destroys them. Inadequate cleaning in the patient's environment is important too, and I will say more about cleaning. And of course, the presence of plastic prostheses, an intravascular catheter, a urinary catheter, a peg into the stomach for feeding. You can bath somebody in disinfectant, but you won't get rid of the MRSA if you don't change that prosthesis, and you may well have to give the patient some prophylactic antibiotics around that change. I call this the ping pong phenomenon because the MRSA will bounce from the inside of a patient to the outside and back again if you don't tackle both aspects of MRSA. The pus cells at the bottom of a wound have the organism sitting inside laughing at you. So a topical clearance regime with a bath and mupirocin up the nose will not get rid of that organism unless you give the patient some antibiotics as well. And finally, relatives. The last little outbreak I had to deal with in a district general hospital was in a care of the elderly ward where a lady who was a wife of one of the patients was a diabetic herself and had been receiving treatment. She actually brought in a strain of MRSA which she was carrying nasally and her husband contracted it. He'd just had major surgery, whereupon, of course, it spread to the other three patients in that same four-bedded area. So we couldn't understand where the MRSA had come from because this particular unit had been free from MRSA for some time, and we eventually traced it back to this relative. Now we'll just go on to the next slide, and I'm going to show you here the results of a study which I'd already mentioned, and this is from Stephen Harbath and his colleagues, published in the Journal of Hospital Infection. And this was a lovely study showing what happens, even in an endemic situation with MRSA, if you institute basic control measures. And the measures, of course, that were introduced were basic: screening and isolation, hand hygiene, and the education to go with it. And it shows from year to year to year the increase in MRSA amongst the lab isolates, the percentage prevalence MRSA among patients, and the number of MRSA and MSSA bacteremias. Of course, the number of MSSA bacteremias doesn't really change very much, but the number of MRSA bacteremias, of course, reaches a peak there in 1994 before it diminishes. The interventions were actually introduced in 1993, and I think they must have had the eye of faith there because, of course, it took some time for those interventions to actually hold good and reduce the amount of MRSA. It's also quite a nice study in other ways because it shows that the prevalence of MRSA in the patients in the hospital is a very nice indicator of the likelihood of the number of MRSA bacteremias. Now, moving on to the next slide. This is just to illustrate the table that I've just showed you in the slide before from the same paper where it shows you along the horizontal axis, the newly colonized and infected patient numbers tabulated against the number of MRSA bacteremias. and you can see there the years as the association rises and then falls back following the intervention. And we'll go to the next slide. What are these basic control measures we have against this organism? And I've put a few there. There's by no means all, but I've decided to just concentrate on these. And they're not in any particular order either. I've got isolation and cohorting, and I must define isolation because there are some papers where they talk about isolation, and this is where the patient's actually put into a side room with the door closed, so strict isolation, as it were. And there's some isolation which is called contact or barrier isolation, and this does mean different things in different countries, but most of the time it means that staff don gloves and aprons and sometimes even masks, and that's contact isolation or barrier isolation. So when you're reading the papers looking at MRSA control interventions, be clear in your mind exactly what the authors are talking about when they say isolation. Cohorting, of course, is where you put patients who have all got MRSA into one particular area. And this, of course, is usually the case when you've exceeded the number of side rooms available. Screening we're going to talk about a great deal, and topical clearance we've mentioned. Education, the education here is not necessarily for the undergraduates. The education here is a program of infection control education to all the hospital staff, from the cleaners to the chief executive. Hand washing, cleaning, and antibiotic management. Now, in the papers that I'm going to describe to you following this slide, I want you to keep your feet on the ground here, because it's, of course, it's human nature that a successful outcome to a particular intervention is far more likely to get published than a negative one. So for every success story, it is quite possible that there are hospitals elsewhere from whom we will never hear who tried to do the same thing and failed. I can only present to you the evidence that is available. Let's carry on. Let's have a look at isolation. Well, my job was made very easy here, and I'm talking mostly about strict isolation here, because we've recently had a UK group who sat down and went through hundreds of papers looking for the positive impact of isolation in the control of MRSA. And they used strict criteria for the quality of their evidence. They found only four, and these four only provided some evidence that isolation was effective. And even then, the isolation was along with other control measures. So I think I can discard isolation right now, because whilst it does have an effect, I think it's minimal compared to what is to come. Let's move on. Here is a paper, and I would say please look at the date of this paper. It's 1982, so it's 20 years ago. But at least it shows us one of the earliest studies about basic screening and contact isolation and the effect it had in this particular hospital. And I would very much like to know what's happening in this hospital now. I don't know, of course. I think this was in the States, this particular study. And also, of course, it does concern me that it is now so old, because it may well be that a flurry of MRSA in a hospital where there hadn't been any before and where there is not being the constant feed of patients positive from the community may well be much easier to control. Let's carry on. There's a huge amount of information on this slide. I'm sorry about that. Let's go through them quickly, one by one. Screening and contact isolation. Screening, isolation and education. And the next. Screening, cohorting and topical clearance. Prospective screening, hand washing and gloving practices. And finally, right at the bottom here, incidence of MRSA ventilator-associated pneumonia decreased after topical clearance regimens and cohorting. But of course they must have done some screening, otherwise they wouldn't have known who to topically clear. I think the message from all these different papers, and there are lots more, is no, I haven't looked at the quality of evidence. specifically all of these, and you may want to, but it's the word screening which comes out to me in all those papers. Let's have a look at more. The next slide. And this is from Barry Farr's fairly recent paper in Lancet Infectious Diseases, where he shows a diagram, which I think he took from another publication, and it's the reservoir for spread. And he likens MRSA in your hospital to an iceberg, and it's only the clinical infections which are the tip of that iceberg. And if you don't go screening and looking, you won't know just how big your iceberg is. There's more on screening. Let's carry on. Successful control programs for MRSA are based on screening and prompt implementation of contact precautions. And then the next paper from Emmanuel Giroux, selective screening for nasal carriage in a medical ICU reduced the rate of MRSA colonization. And then we have two publications which really do elevate screening, perhaps more than anything else, and a very effective measure to control your MRSA. The Rhode Island guidelines and then the Shea guidelines, published very recently, just a year ago, I think, looking at the nosocomial transmission of MRSA and enterococcus. Those latter two publications underline, without any doubt in my mind, the importance of screening. And my next slide, I'm going to give to Andreas Voss at that same conference and his comment on screening, which you can read for yourself. You can't control what you don't know about. Let's carry on. Mopping up MRSA. Aside from screening, which has resource implications, we've got cleaning. Now, that has resource implications as well. But there is a small amount of evidence that the basic cleaning can have a significant impact on MRSA acquisition. Now, my own review there was a desperate attempt to find evidence for controlling hospital-acquired infection, including MRSA. I had to resort to anecdotes and letters to write that review because there was so little in the general press. And, of course, that's because cleaning has never been regarded as an evidence-based science. I think we have to look at it as such. And I applaud Anita Rampling for her work. She was very keen to get rid of an epidemic MRSA on a men's urological ward, where she found that at least a third of the patients who picked up the epidemic strain of MRSA had significant infection. And she targeted cleaning. I wonder why. I don't know whether she'd read my review. Probably not. I think she just decided herself, as I had, and as I think a lot of microbiologists believe, that cleaning can have a positive impact on control. And, of course, she did show that very nicely and saved £28,000 as well. Then the comment from Barry Farr about cleaning is that, what's the point in getting everybody to wash their hands if the next item they touch has MRSA on it? And if we go to the next slide, there must be a way of measuring bacteriological cleanliness in the environment, and we cannot rely on a visual assessment, shown so nicely by Chris Griffiths. A visual assessment of a ward means nothing. It's very important for patient aesthetics. The patient themselves look at a ward and it's clutter, and they put two and two together. This is a dirty ward and I got my infection from there. But the two don't necessarily go together. I know of care of the elderly wards which look grubby and which are cluttered, but the patients never get MRSA. And I know of intensive care units which gleam, where there's at least a fatal case of MRSA every other week. And you can find it in the environment. We need to look for microbiological standards for surface hygiene, and we can use the Hatchett principles, and we can steal the ideas in the food industry. Moving on. Hand washing. Hand washing is the single most effective thing to break the cycle of infection. There's no doubt about that. And this classic paper by Didier Pitet shows very, very nicely exactly what you can do with a hand hygiene program. You will reduce your overall hospital-acquired infection, as he and his co-authors say, and you reduce your MRSA transmission rate, as shown there. I think the calculation was that 900 patients had been spared MRSA due to this control program. That represents a lot of money. We'll move to the next slide. And this just shows you the results of Didier Pittet's work in the hospital in Geneva after a program of hand hygiene education. And you can see there the decrease in new MRSA cases over the next 2 or 3 years following the intervention. We'll move on to the next slide. I have to say something about the role of antibiotics in the control of MRSA, because antibiotics have generated MRSA. They're spreading in the hospitals because mostly of poor hygiene, but we're continuing to use antibiotics on a huge global scale, so there is going to continue this proliferation of the organism and subsequent spread. And this slide here shows you exactly how that happens at a microbial level, in that if you have one cell in a population with the genetics for methicillin resistance, then you're going to end up with ultimately nothing but that resistant cell following antibiotic treatment. And if we move on, here, this particular slide shows you the difference in antimicrobial consumption across Europe. It's a very interesting slide. I don't have time to say much more about it, except that you can see that the countries which have a lower incidence of MRSA appear not to use many antibiotics, and also the type of antibiotics that they use. They use more of the narrow-spectrum penicillins and less of the broad-spectrum, particularly cephalosporins and indeed quinolones. The UK doesn't look too bad there from the antimicrobial consumption point of view, but of course you know, as I do, that the MRSA epidemiology is particularly complex. Let's move on. And this is ERIS data again, and I just wanted to show you at the far end of that slide there, the low rates of MRSA, again from Denmark and the Netherlands, who don't use antibiotics as much as we and other countries do, and who tend to use the narrower spectrum agents. And following that, yes, if you can change or restrict the antibiotics in your hospital, you will see an impact. I've given you 5 references there. That there are 2 reviews from Dominique Monet and myself on the impact of certain classes of antibiotics. In particular, we've targeted cephalosporins and Dominique Monet quinolones too. And the other papers, Frank and Landman in particular, show that you can significantly reduce your MRSA by improving your antibiotic prescribing. So that's an overall drop in antibiotics, and you save money, according to the Frank study. And of course, what they did was they reduced the amount of cephalosporins, and the Landman paper, carbapenems and other antibiotics too. So the next slide. And as I've got so little time left, 5 minutes, I'm going to leave this slide because you can see it on your handout and move on. And this was a study that was done by Fiona McKenzie and colleagues in Aberdeen. I don't think they've published this yet, but it's just to show you a time-lagged association between the consumption of macrolides, cephalosporin, and quinolones, and the incidence of MRSA in the Aberdeen Royal Infirmary. And this was a time-lagged, and its reason why it's time-lagged is because, of course, resistance doesn't follow immediately. It takes some time to follow antibiotic, an introduction of a new antibiotic or an increased amount of a particular antibiotic being used in the hospital. This is nice work, and I'm sure there are other groups doing this. This is based on a Spanish model. We'll move on. And this is just to show, if you weren't convinced, a relationship between beta-lactam antibiotics and penicillin-resistant pneumococci. And this was from Stefan Bronswire's work in Emerging Infectious Diseases. And I'm going to try and explain, and you can target me on this, why there's an association between beta-lactams and penicillin-resistant pneumo. And I think it's probably because the pneumococcus is a community organism that's far easier to get a handle on. If we look at the next slide, you'll see that the UK there, which is sort of fourth down from the bottom at the end there, is pretty good on the penicillin resistance stakes, and we're dropping. And we wonder whether it's because of this, on the next slide, the fact that there's been an overall decrease in the amount of antibiotics prescribed by general practitioners. This is English data, but it's shown in Scotland as well, and we have seen a similar slight drop in the incidence of penicillin resistance in pneumococci. Perhaps we should really target our antimicrobial prescribing in the hospitals and show the same impact on MRSA. We'll carry on to the next slide. My conclusion is that simple control measures for MRSA work. There is nothing wrong with the guidelines. We need motivation and we need leadership from infection control staff. And these infection control staff need support from managers and policymakers at all levels. And this is what we've seen in Scotland over the last year. There has been motivation and there has been leadership. And it was because of a hospital-acquired infection task force generated by the government, with at least 28 working groups, pulling in microbiologists, infection control nurses, and all sorts of other NHS professional staff to look at every aspect of HAI in our hospital. And this impetus, I think, goes some way to explaining why we've seen our MRSA rates steadying. Well, there's been a bit of a ding-dong between myself and my very good friend and colleague, Steve Barrett, who is the editor of the Journal of Hospital Infection, because Steve says, and he has a point, that controlling MRSA can cause more problems than it solves. Granted. But I think we have to stop this MRSA pendulum swinging, and I think we have to decide what we're going to do about this organism. My next slide, from Barry Farr and William Jarvis, and I applaud their courage in saying this. They say that those of us accustomed to the high rate of MRSA should consider their current national rate with that of countries such as Denmark and Holland, and say to themselves, are you comfortable with our MRSA rate in our country? Because the difference in outcome appears to be one of choice and not chance.